And welcome to our Saturday morning podcast. Somebody I've known for a long time, because when you live out west and you drive around in Los Angeles, he's part of an incredibly popular afternoon show, Petros and Money with Matt Money on AM 570 LA Sports. He's a former USC football player. He was a team captain, kind of a sage for his age. He's done analyst work for multiple networks. I brought him on the herd before. Petros Papadakis is joining us, and he's always thoughtful. And, you know, I think you're a perfect guest for our Saturday podcast, because we can ramble here a little bit. Let's start with this. And we're both ramblers. California's a different state to live in. We're more liberal. We've got more restrictions, but we have this incredible quality of life. And I think the expense and the regulations may scare some people off, and the liberal politics, but I think it's the best place I've ever lived in my life. With that said, and I think you probably agree, it's just an amazing place, the food, the people, the opportunities, the beaches, the mountains. But were you frustrated during this virus as other parts of the country were opening up and California was not?
Oh, yeah. I think we've all been really frustrated. And I think some people are frustrated for the opposite reason. They're scared that California's opening up too early. You know, with this thing, Colin, for me, it's been really tough, just like I think for everybody, because usually, even if I'm wrong, and I know you can relate with this, I usually feel like I have a lasso over what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, I might be wrong. I might be naive. I might be arrogant about it. But usually I feel comfortable if I feel like I have a lasso over what's happening. Like I understand it. This, I don't. You know, there's people I love and trust that think I'm crazy because I've been going into the studio for this whole time because I don't like it when the shows go from home. They don't sound that good.
Same here, yeah.
Yeah. You know, so, and then I have people that think I'm crazy if I'm wearing a mask when I walk into the studio. So, and they're all people that I love and trust. So it's a really hard way to just go about it every day. Some days you're really scared about things, some days you're not. As far as California goes, like, I've never lived anywhere else. So it's hard for me because, you know, I've lived in this weird place. You know, I grew up mostly in Rancho Palos Verdes and in San Pedro, which is kind of like the harbor where the ghetto meets the sea. It is the oldest settled community in on the West Coast, is San Pedro. So it's an odd kind of place to be from. You know, I was saying the other day, you know, these guys, ugly guys that we travel with, you know, like me, they go to Lubbock and people are just fascinated with them because they're from Los Angeles. You know?
Right.
You know, they're not a celebrity. The guy works in a truck. It's just that he's from Los Angeles. You know, people think of this as a mythical kind of golden place. And in many ways it is. This has been frustrating, but I think it's been frustrating, you know, for everybody.
Yeah. You know, Petros, as somebody that I broadcast, you know, as you know, it lands in all 50 states in some point. And
the globe.
Yeah. And so I've always kind of taken a cautious approach on things I don't really know. I don't do a lot of politics because I'm not as well versed in it. People, you know, I see people offering stock tips online. It's like, no, that's not what I do. Right. I'll do football picks. I'm good. And with the virus, I said one thing very early. Well, two things. I said, this is not going to be a 4-week thing. It's going to be a 4-month, 6-month thing. That was the first thing I said the first day. The second thing I said is, I think social distancing matters. I have moved to a third thing in terms of, we don't really know what this is, which is, I think being outdoors, you're not going to get it mostly, and just get out in the sun, exercise, move. I'm pretty sure Manhattan Beach, most of the beach communities, people are all over the place, but they're outdoors jogging quickly past each other. So those are the three things now I've said I absolutely believe. Go outdoors. If you can't wear a mask, just give people space. because I'm seeing all these beach communities. We don't see a huge number of cases. I think we went a month at one point. Manhattan Beach didn't have a case or had one. So do you have anything you absolutely believe to be true with this and not true with all the information out on COVID?
The one truth, I think, is a contradiction. And I do think that this whole thing has been a very crude instrument and necessary, perhaps, and that is up to somebody else to say. Like you said, you know, I'm not the guy that's going to sit here and help people with medical information. Like, when this whole thing started, the one thing I understood that I needed to do was to entertain people and try to be lighthearted and get to work. You know, I didn't want to be the guy that was predicting that when things were going to come back or telling people how horrible everything is. I just wanted to help people get through it. Now, that being said, when it comes to the beach, Colin, you know, I live over here by Redondo, and the Redondo Beach and I think Hermosa reached out and said, like, hey, would you do a public service announcement to tell people to stay off the beach and this and that? And I was like, you know, not really. I don't want to, because I think it's ridiculous. I drive by the beach, and they had it all roped off for months, and it was depressing to me.
Yeah.
And I couldn't understand it. You know, in Redondo, they have a sidewalk, two sidewalks, and then an esplanade way down by the water, and they had the sidewalk and the esplanade roped off. Well, what do you think's going to happen? The one side of the street is packed with people like a New York thoroughfare. And that's not social distancing, right? You know, I mean, they closed a bunch of walking trails here where I live, you know, for walking. And what happens? Well, now there's big herds of people walking down the middle of the street, you know, people fighting with cars and joggers and bikers getting in, you know, the little tiffs over who's wearing a mask and who's not. That's the kind of little stuff. You know, New York says it's okay to be on the wet sand, but not the dry sand, but not the wet sand. California says you can be on the wet sand, but not the dry sand. You know, that's the stuff, that minutia, like you said, that drives people crazy. And I know enough doctors that said, hey, look, you know, I worked on Ebola, and the thing dies in the sun. You know, that's kind of common with this kind of stuff. So that part of it, you know, seeing the beach roped off, seeing people's access to the water is really the life's blood of California. You know, even people that live hours from the water know how to get to the water. And when you cut that off, I think you really, you're really cutting people down just as far as what their self-esteem can be. You know, just to, I don't go in the water much, but I like to look at it.
Yeah.
And it was hard to go look at it, you know, to see all these cones and all these restrictions and all these signs that no one was really sure, you know, if they're being effective or not. That frustrated me, and I did talk a little bit on the air about that. Just
Petros,
I'm from the beach.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you should. I think you have insight. Petros Papadakis, former USC football player. I was thinking the other day, I have not also predicted when leagues would start, but I made a prediction about 2 months ago. I said, here's my only sports prediction. The SEC is going to have a season. They're more football than academics. That's nothing against all the fine universities, but it does matter more there. The Pac-12 says, okay, June 15th, it took them a while, we're all in. Do you believe they're all in, or it's more a toes in the water because they feel some pressure that with recruiting, if they're literally anti-football, that it's just, this is a key time to recruit, and it could really be, it could be puncturing any recruiting momentum, especially with like a USC or an Oregon that recruit nationally in Stanford? Or do you believe they're really all in? If kids get cases, the Pac-12 is fine? Because my history of this conference is it's more academic leaning than the SEC or the Big 12 or the ACC.
More academic leaning, more Olympic sport leaning, more multicultural leaning. You know, it's like the West Coast that you described when we started. And I am passionate about Pac-10 football, you know, and it turned to the Pac-12 while I've been doing this, you know, about 10 years in. And I love the Pac-12. I wish it was thriving more. Unfortunately, they really crippled themselves with some terrible decisions years ago, as you know. And they did step out into the light and make their own TV network and all that. One of the worst decisions anybody's ever made. You know, now it's not worth anything. they needed to strike while the iron was hot and do a deal with Fox, us, or, you know, ESPN, or NBC was the one I heard they were really far down the road with. But instead, Larry Scott, their commissioner, went and did something boldly that no one else thought of doing, and it was a horrible idea. He tried to start his own media company. That's killed the Pac-12. That and the fact that USC hasn't really competed at a very high national level for a decade. And that really just cuts the Pac-12 down horribly. Ever since that, they're a follower, right? We had John Canzano on the show, who's a great West Coast writer, as you know, and radio guy up in Oregon. And he said, when we asked the same question about the leagues coming back, he said, well, the Pac-12 is going to wait and see what everybody else does, and then they'll do something. They're a follower now. They have to be, because they've been so injured when they try to step out and do something more adventurous, which was a horrible decision on their part. So at this point, I mean, Larry Scott's just going to listen to about 400 committees that they hire and overpay and just do what everybody else says. So, you know, you start on June 1st, we start on June 7th, and, oh, well, we're going to start on June 15th. You know, okay, whatever, guys. they're followers, and they will follow suit with what the SEC and the Big Ten and the Big 12 do.
Petros Papadakis, we'll take a quick break. Back after this. Petros Papadakis, Matt and Money in L.A. You know him on 570 L.A. Sports. Petros and Money, former USC football player, Fox Sports college football analyst, and a sage, all full of wisdom. Let's talk about what you think college football, fans-wise, will look like in the fall. Your gut feeling.
You know, I saw a story that they want to fill Kinnick in Iowa last night, that Iowa was one of the places where they're talking about full stadiums. And, you know, the one thing that's really interesting to me, and I think, you know, of all people, you can relate with this better than anybody, I mean, because you have to dive into media every day and pull out, like, bobbing for apples.
Right.
You know, and the apple that you pull out with your mouth, you know, you don't want it to be a rotten apple filled with COVID news and filled with all this crap. You know, you want it to be something that you can talk about and make entertaining and make analogies for your fans, you know. And, you know, it's hard because information from 2 weeks ago changes. You know, information from, I remember the Cal State LA, what was that, a month ago? And there's three schools here that play. They're on people's schedules: Fresno State, San Diego State, San Jose State. Sometimes they're really good, and they're in the Mountain West. And Cal State schools said, hey, no one's on campus in the fall. They said that like 2 months ago.
Yep.
And suddenly there was a reverberation through the Mountain West and a reverberation through the people who balanced the books for Cal State. And call it, it was 30 hours later, they came out and said, well, you know, people can be on campus for labs. And then they said, well, you know, if they can be on campus for labs, then of course we can have guys working out. And that whole thing buckled. But nobody really reported on the buckling. They just reported on the original shock of no students in the fall. Though that's not true at all. And it's changed. So to me, I hate telling people who are season ticket holders or people that, I mean, the people that go to college football games, it's a tribal lifestyle thing for them. Those six or seven games, as you know, they base their whole year around them that they go to. And I'm not comfortable sitting there telling those people that they're not going to be able to do what they want in the fall, because I have no idea. You know, I don't know what it's going to look like. But I'm assuming by August, things will be dramatically different. And we will have a different perspective on how to go about this. And hopefully we'll already have seen sports, baseball, basketball, some without fans and then some, you know, with some fans going through the summer. So I'm optimistic about the fans.
Yeah. You know, I'm a huge college football fan. I talk less college football now than the NFL substantially, and I did not 10 years ago. That is because it's become very regionalized, which is not good for my syndicated business. So I used to talk USC all the time because I knew I'd have a West Coast audience, and then I have a Southern audience, and Big Ten fans are obviously rabid. the sport has become, to me, too regionalized, and I think there's only one way to solve that, and the only way to solve that is USC. It is the only West Coast program, Denver West, that has the resources, the history, the money, and the tradition, and the recruiting base to get 7 5-star players in a single class. Now, USC finally got rid of older defensive coaches who, frankly, could not recruit and would not recruit. They've got now Todd Orlando, Texas guy, high energy, risk taker, blitzer, good salesman. Does that save Clay Helton's job? A younger, more aggressive staff, or are we just biding time with the current program?
Yeah, I think it's the latter. I know Todd, and you know most of the games. Yeah, that's the truth, Colin. Like when I started doing this, I did mostly only West Coast games. Now, you know, 90% of the games I call are outside of California, and 80% are outside of the Pac-12 conference. And the perception for USC amongst the coaches, because, you know, everybody knows I'm a West Coast guy, is really changed. I mean, it has changed. Most coaches that I talk to, they roll their eyes. They say, if I had that roster, I could teach those guys technique and develop those players and so on and so forth. You know, nothing that you haven't heard over the years. But Clay Helton, who is, I mean, the disclaimer is, very likable guy. Everybody likes him, if you know him. Not everybody, because he's fired 13 assistant coaches to keep his job there. And that's unheard of in many college football circles. That doesn't make you very popular amongst your peers. Remember, Todd Orlando was fired at Texas.
Right.
And he took a linebacker job at Texas Tech for his old friend Matt Wells, who's a very good coach from Utah State, who's now at Texas Tech. And he got saved by Clay. And they have Graham Harrell there, and they run an air raid. An air raid with a blitzing offense, not necessarily a great great combo. You're taking a lot of chances on both sides of the ball. You know, it's really, USC needs to be relevant nationally for the West Coast to be relevant nationally. You understand that. And the fact that you get that, despite your background at Washington, which is one of my favorite programs in the world, is really not startling, but telling. Because Washington's a great program, but they're tucked up in there in Seattle, and they don't move the needle nationally.
And there's only about 6 legitimate big-time players in the state year after year. I mean, if you go look at the history of college football, there's a very clear trend. If your state doesn't produce 20 elite Division I players, you can't be year after year an elite power. It's almost Oregon has become a fringe elite power basically because of Phil Knight and the marketing.
Right, and they come down here and recruit both of those schools. I mean, everybody does. But it's sad because U.S., like the Pac-12, their network is a huge problem and it's not solvable. It's by the time they come around to making a new deal, it's not going to be worth anything. We talked about that. But the one quick fix is, you know, hire Urban Meyer. Hire Bob Stoops. Hire one of those coaches, and it changed the entire perception of the West Coast football. Like, it immediately, everything would change. And you don't hire Urban Meyer just so Urban Meyer can coach your team. You hire him so he can hire Ryan Day and develop that coach, or Tom Herman, or Alex Grinch. You know, you hire Lincoln Riley so he can you hire Bob Stoops so he can find Lincoln Riley at an ECU. And hire him. You know, Clay Helton, the real knock on him for years, and I've known the Helton family since I was a child because Kim Helton was the offensive line coach for the Raiders when they were in L.A. and they were in El Segundo, and Tyson Helton, who's the head coach at Western Kentucky, was our freshman team quarterback when I played football. I know the Heltons. The Heltons are people in coaching that are protectors. They don't want anybody around the head coach, if it's one of them, that has any kind of threat to the head coach. You know, like a hot coordinator, like Lincoln Riley to Bob Stoops. That's an untenable situation for a Helton. And that's kept USC pretty weak just as far as staffing, other than the fact that he didn't really know anybody. But now they have a new athletic director who's building a lot of new roads to the media. But to me, you know, the emperor still has no clothes if the head coach is still the head coach. We'll see what the season looks like, but I don't think it's beyond the realm. I mean, in recruiting, USC's been recruiting at the highest level, top five recruiting classes for years. The letters recruit themselves. Like, I played for Paul Hackett and was able to get Carson Palmer to sign with us. The letters recruit themselves. It's not that. Last year was so negative that USC had a terrible recruiting class. Every other year, they're right up there with the teams they're supposed to recruit with. The unfortunate part is those players are not being developed. Colin, in the last 3 years, UCLA, or 4 years, have probably been the worst ever of UCLA football than we can in the lifetime of the program, right?
Right, yeah, no question.
They have outdrafted USC in the last 3 years, 22 to 21. They've had more guys drafted. And if you compare those recruiting classes, I mean, it's a joke. USC, you know, and it's just very clear that USC is not developing the players.
Yeah.
And that's a coaching thing. And, I mean, it's amazing the hoops that people have jumped through to try to keep Clay Helton there. And I happen to know the reason why. But I think people are tired of hearing it from me, and that's okay. You know, and I understand that because it's been a barrage of negativity for 10 years, and a lot of people just don't want to hear me spew the bile anymore, which I understand.
Well, I think at some point, Lynn Swann extended his contract, and now they don't have the money to buy him out. Is that perhaps?
Oh, they have money. That's the other funny thing. You know, these colleges are these, like, you go to these places, and they're these giant utopias. They're always building. They're never out of money. And then they're the first people to cry, we don't have any money. It's amazing. From what I understand, they were all the way down the road with Bob Stoops for those weird 6 weeks that Mike Bone didn't fire Clay Helton. And suddenly the university president balked and would not let Mike Bone hire Urban Meyer or Stoops. I think it was Stoops. And let him staff, basically give him full control. And, you know, you couldn't get Bruce Rawlinson, the coach at Mater Dei in Orange County, to come to USC unless he gave him full control. You know, USC just doesn't get that. So for me, it's control. You know, they lost control. Pete Carroll took control from Mike Garrett. He became a bigger star in town than the athletic director when college football flourished, when USC was great, the salad days, as my radio partner would say, that we always talk about, the Leinart and Bush days and beyond. So Pete Carroll got him in trouble, right? He cut a bunch of corners. He broke a bunch of rules. They had the Reggie controversy, and they had crippling sanctions. Ever since then, they've wanted a coach that they can control, whether it's Kiffin, whether it's Sark, and then the ultimate minion is Clay, and they want to have their utopia, and the people in charge there really, really were rooted in. Now, a lot of those people are being uprooted, but a lot of them are still there, and it just seems like they need their country club more than they need USC to be successful. Having a guy like Bob Stoops come in and kick a bunch of boosters off the plane and say, no, this is how we do it from now on, is just unacceptable to them. And it has been for a decade, and that's a big part of the reason why not only is USC struggling, which is what they deserve because of the decisions they've made, but the West Coast in football is struggling, which we don't deserve. And that really kills me, because USC football being bad, you know, hurts Arizona, hurts Washington, hurts everybody, because it hurts the eyeballs from the East Coast. The East Coast really only recognizes USC. I don't know if it's an OJ thing or a Lynn Swann thing or Ricky Bell or what it is, but nobody moves the needle on the, you know, people aren't going to watch Cal unless Cal's playing a really good USC team most of the time. And I just don't know how we're going to get back to that under the current administration.
Petros Papadakis, one final question. You're also an observer of the media, and I am interested in it. Try to stay out of the gossip, but I'm interested in it. And one of the things I've noticed, you know, we have a president that sort of weaponizes social media. And it's made a country that was partisan even more divided and at times unhinged. Now we have a candidate, Joe Biden, also older, with it appears to be some cognitive decline. I'm being nice. I don't remember in my life having a presidential election where I don't feel comfortable with either candidate. But I also equally don't feel comfortable with the current state of American media.
Right.
It is so partisan, so unhinged, so over the top, that I mostly stay out of politics because I think the audience is seeking people who aren't partisan. What's your take on your show and your belief, what we have going forward, and sort of the media's role in the divide in the country?
Well, one thing I'm always proud of is, you know, people text me and say, you know, you liberal fool, you know, and then people text me and say, you conservative animal.
Yeah,
you know,
I get that too. Yeah.
So no one really knows. And that's how I like to keep it. but overall, like, you know, it's so divisive. I go on Clay Travis's show once a week. I have ever since he started his radio show. Clay and I are friends. We don't agree on most things, but we are friends. And people don't even hear those interviews and demand that I not go on that show and demand that that I renounce Clay and renounce all that's being said, or I am a killer and I am somehow complicit in death. I tweeted a photo the other day, Colin. It was a Photoshop of Matt and I on a tandem bike with our faces photoshopped on like the Three's Company tandem bike, right?
Yeah.
And people tweeted under the tweet, I'm done with this show. No mask, irresponsible. It's a two-dimensional. We were never on the beach, you know. Those kinds of reactions just really turn me off. And I got to tell you, I turn on the computer to look at stuff and I am just so disheartened, and so some days I just feel drowned in information that is, I just so much agree with the media part, because I've never felt before in our lifetime since I've been doing this that we've constantly been being gaslighted by the media. And it's like every media outlet, whatever side you're on, is much more like a fan site than it is an actual media outlet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I gave Vox a chance, and about a month in, I'm like, okay, they're partisan. I'm always looking. It's one of the reasons I think Joe Rogan has succeeded. He's a little bit of a heterodox. He doesn't care. He's just looking to – he's trying to find people that are interesting and that have the right answers to stuff, and he doesn't care either way, and he gets tons of hate mail. Now, I didn't love him interviewing Alex Jones because I lived in Connecticut during that awful tragedy. But I think part of Joe Rogan's appeal, I was reading it in the New York Times this week, is that he just wants the right answer. He doesn't come in with the answer.
Yeah, and there's one thing, like obviously, like you know, he's been wildly successful and found a way to connect with a lot of people through honesty, through his brand of honesty. I think if you're dishonest or if people see you as somebody who is calculated or has an agenda, that they sniff that out right away, and then you're just being propped up by a network. Obviously, guys that really move the needle, and there's no stopping them. He's one of those people, you know. Your show is like that. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, people say, hey, did you hear this? Did you hear that on that show? What really bothers me just about all of it is just the cancel culture and the demand for apology constantly. And that is a great rule of thumb that I've heard from a few people over these last few years when our political environment has just become so, so charged and toxic. Is just don't apologize. You know, if you felt like you didn't do anything wrong and there's a bunch of outraged people, the second you apologize to them, you know, you've become their bitch. And now they get to police you or morally kind of have a high ground on you, and you have to sit there with your eyes darting around for the rest of your life, worried about what you might or might say that could offend somebody. The best thing to do is just trust your instincts and go forward. And, you know, we all say and do stupid things from time to time, but, you know, our audience does too. They trust us and they want us to to bring them through the day. And I think that's just the best advice. You know, just try to find some honesty in your heart when you're going to do this stuff, because looking at the information gets so confusing. I mean, could you imagine actually being in the news right now, Colin, and what you would decide to go with every day?
Oh, it's. I saw something yesterday where an ABC News reporter on Twitter said he named like 11 states that they've opened them up and there doesn't appear to be a surge in viruses. And it was met with utter disdain from the audience when he was just reporting data. They were not all states with conservative governors. And I thought, he's just a reporter giving you data. It would be like me saying Aaron Rodgers is talented and getting deluged with hate mail.
It's amazing, you know, because, and it is funny when you look at it, because if you have a Twitter feed like you do or I do, and you tweet something out and you start seeing, you know, something under it like, you partisan a-hole, I'm done with you, this or that. If you look at that Twitter page, it's usually just some wildly partisan Twitter page. You know, they're these wildly political people that are on Twitter all day in order to be political. Like, most people's Twitter is not super political. Most people, I think, are like you and I. They want to coexist. They want to be together. They want everything to be okay. They don't want to be divided. They really don't. You look at their Twitter pages, if they have one, and they're, you know, picture of their kids, a song they like, you know, maybe something political here and there. But the people that are outraged are 100% political. They're saturated in it, and they live it all day. And if you want to live it with them, all you got to do is log in and get emotionally swooned by it. And it's hard, you know, because we're all vulnerable in different times. I might have a couple of whiskeys, and then you look at Twitter and you feel devastated half the time. You know, so it is something, you know, that everybody has to, I think, temper. But the train has left the station, and it's I don't know how it's going to be under control anytime soon, because it's just such a, I mean, it's such a great medium, but it's also horrible too. It's really both of those things at the exact same time.
Yeah, when Tim Russert died, I kind of felt like the center of the political spectrum died with him. He was one of those guys where I always felt, he's given it to me straight, and I think increasingly it's hard to find that voice. Maybe it is Joe Rogan.
I got so disillusioned as a young person working at my father's restaurant, Colin, because my dad, for people that don't know, he had a very famous Greek restaurant for 40 years.
Yeah.
We only owned one restaurant, but and I couldn't imagine going through that right now. We'd be closed and we'd be hemorrhaging and suffering like so many are. But every local politician, like Ronald Reagan, I served there. I served Pete Wilson. I served every local politician, every national politician, you know, every California political person we had in the restaurant. And I saw these people when they're at their most vulnerable, you know, when I was 10 years old. I don't respect local politicians, you know, and all of a sudden I'm supposed to act like these people are heroes. I can't do it. You know, I know what they're like. So that's been really hard for me. You know, when you see behind the curtain a little bit as a young guy, you know, as a busboy, it's awful tough to take Eric Garcetti seriously.
Yeah. What a pleasure it's been. Petros Papadakis, excuse me.
Colin, let me explain this to you. There is no wrong way to say the name.
All right.
Because if you're in Greece, the way to pronounce it makes it sound like you're trying too hard. Like if you're, you know, hey, Colin, we're getting down to Guatemala. You know, you're not going to say that. It would be Papazakis. But no one says that. You know, I don't say that. I say Papadakis. I say Papadakis. I say both of them. So please, please, ease your mind about it.
Well, I love bringing you on my Saturday podcast because the country listens. And I really wanted to dig deeper into L.A. and your kind of sensibility on all this. You're wildly talented. You have, for your age, you have, and I don't know how old you are. I figure 40-ish years old.
42.
Yeah, you got a lot of wisdom. You're a very smart guy. And I'm glad I could share you for people who hadn't heard you in the country on this platform, buddy. And it's great talking to you. I listen all the time. Thank you, man.
Colin, when you call, it's like when your booker calls, it's like it's like Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny and the Tooth Fairy all calling at the same time. I really relish the opportunity to speak to you and your audience. So thank you.